topic of the Shir, Utopian Yerushalayim, Destroyed Yerushalayim. Want to have our learning today be a zechut, a merit for all the soldiers who have been injured in the war of the past many weeks. We should all have speedy recoveries. We shouldn't have such a large number of injured soldiers for a very, very, very long time to come. What I want to do today is look at two utopian Yerushalayims in the Torah, or in one in the Nevi'im, one from the Mishnah, but really a third that will give us an extra dimension of understanding into the first two. That third is the utopian Yerushalayim that I think that I will argue destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. And that is not, to be clear, a Torah Yerushalayim. But in order to understand, right, we know that the second Beit HaMikdash, and I'm talking about the second Beit HaMikdash, destroyed because of baseless hatred. In order to really understand, well, what was the root of that root, we have to understand the mindsets of different Jews during the period. Before I go on to introduce these utopian conceptions of Yerushalayim, what I want to do is just call our attention to an interpretive difference between Septuagint on the one hand and a few other ancient sources and the primary Masorah as to how to interpret a couple of words from the third pasuk of this coming week's Haftarah, the first source on your handout. Everyone have the handout? If you don't have a handout, our extra over here. Anyone need a handout here? Anyone has here? Kol Kore Bamidbar. Not end of the cartridge handout. I think there probably are a couple circulating like that as well. Kol korei b'midbar panu derech Hashem, yashu barava, misila le'lokenu. Right? How do you translate the first few words? How do you translate the first few words? Kol korei b'midbar. I wanted to fit everything onto one page. I'm sorry, I didn't give you translations. A voice calls out in the wilderness. Everyone agree? Right? The question is it a voice calling out and saying what? In the wilderness, establish a path? Or is it a voice calling out in the wilderness? Right? If you think about modern English versus modern Hebrew, we have this phrase is very influential. And we have in modern English, we have a voice crying out, which is basically a voice broadcast in the middle of nowhere that no one listens to, right? A voice calling out in the wilderness. And then in contrast, in modern Hebrew, we have a voice calling out, a kol korei, which is a voice broadcast everywhere that no one listens to. Right? Kol korei b'midbar panu derech Hashem. And again, the standard interpretation of almost all the commentators is that it is a voice calling out, and it's saying, establish the path of Hashem in the wilderness. But there's another question here, actually. Which direction is the path going in? We know that the prophecy is taking place in Yerushalayim, a calling to this Yerushalayim that will be Nachon Yeh Har Beit Hashem, high up. Okay. So we've got Yerushalayim and we've got the Midbar. Where is the highway going? Is it the highway going toward Yerushalayim? Or is it the highway going away from Yerushalayim into the wilderness? And that, I think, is an even more crucial distinction. Right? When it comes to the question of whether it's Kol Karei Bamidbar or Kol Karei, right, we have the notes, the Ta'amei Mikra, make it clear that our tradition sees it as a Kol Karei Bamidbar Panu Derech Hashem. Kol Karei Bamidbar Panu Derech Hashem. Right? Kol Karei is separate. Right? But we still don't know which direction is the highway going in. And that's a key question. Because the question is, if we want to build the ideal society, what do we have to do? Do we have to call from Yerushalayim and say, build a highway in the Midbar to Yerushalayim? Makes a lot of sense to me. Just came back from Yerushalayim. Actually had the tremendous zechut of living there for a month. Wish it weren't during a war. It was beautiful nonetheless. Or is it that you have to leave Yerushalayim and go out into the wilderness in order to build the ideal? So I think there are actually, we're going to see this tension here. The first utopian Yerushalayim, I believe, is the utopian Yerushalayim of Yechezkel. Think about the structure of Yechezkel. Yechezkel starts with the tremendous revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, incomprehensible to us, but essential to our appreciation of Avodat Hashem. It's the source of the Kedusha, together with Yeshayahu's revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Then Yechezkel, who sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in all its glory and sees it in the Beit HaMikdash, then sees it leaving the Beit HaMikdash. This is happening while he's in Babylonia in exile with the first round of exiles before the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed in 597. Beit HaMikdash is then destroyed in 586. Then, a few years later, the end of Yechezkel, the final nine prakim of Yechezkel, starting with Perek Mem, he sees the Shechina returned to the Beit HaMikdash. And he sees a very different Beit HaMikdash. And he describes that Beit HaMikdash in tremendous detail. That's the utopian Yerushalayim. And he doesn't just describe the Beit HaMikdash, he describes the Yerushalayim that it's in. And the relationship of the Beit HaMikdash geographically with other important places in Yerushalayim. Right, so that's source two. And you can see in Perek Mem Gimel, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's return to the Beit HaMikdash, very similar language to what we have in Yechezkel's initial Nevuah, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has this tremendous revelation, right? V'atisayin ruach v'ashma, right? I'm hearing and I'm seeing. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is returning. And what's the most important thing that is structurally different about this Beit HaMikdash from the Beit HaMikdash that was just destroyed? I don't know whether anyone's recently learned Yechezkel. Four sections. What? Four sections. Okay, the sections. But I actually want to talk about the relationship of the Beit HaMikdash to the rest of Yerushalayim and to another important structure in Yerushalayim.
Different,
you know, it's like striving for the Shvatim. Okay. And who is the focus? The focus is on the Shvatim who are in there. Who is the focus not on?
The king.
Right? The kings who, like the kings during the first Beit HaMikdash times, turned their backs to the Beit HaMikdash, and they had these beautiful palaces right next to the Beit HaMikdash. And they used the Beit HaMikdash as a political structure rather than a structure that's the home for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way to get the people closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? And there's a major division. There are tremendous walls around the Beit HaMikdash preventing the king, so to speak, from entering into that Beit HaMikdash. And you see it described in Perek Mem Gimel Pasuk Chet, which I have at the end of source 2. It's very important, though, when we think about Yechezkel's vision of the Beit HaMikdash, and I'm not going to, we don't have time, obviously, to learn all 9 prakim. It's important to recognize when this prophecy is taking place. Right? Why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu wait to give the utopian Yerushalayim after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed? Okay. Okay, we need that the next Beit HaMikdash will be the right Beit HaMikdash. By the way, which Beit HaMikdash is Yechezkel describing? The third. Right? We say that now. Is it clear that does he say I'm describing the third Beit HaMikdash? It wasn't clear that there had to be a third Beit HaMikdash. He could have been describing the second Beit HaMikdash. Right? And if you have Yechezkel in mind, then when we experience the people who saw the building at the very beginnings of the building of the second Beit HaMikdash and were old enough to remember what the first Beit HaMikdash looked like. And what does Ezra describe them as doing? They're crying. Why are they crying? They're crying because it's tiny in comparison. And Yechezkel's, the splendor is overwhelming. Right? It could have been. Right? And Haggai and Zechariah say it still can be, even though it's little now, we can continue building. And here's the amazing thing, actually. If you look at the history of the building of the second Beit HaMikdash, over the course of the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, it was expanded and expanded, and it did become more beautiful in grandeur, at least in terms of its outward appearance. Right? Whatever Yechezkel is describing as the ideal utopian Yerushalayim, it's clearly not just a matter of the aesthetics. It's very important that we recognize that Yechezkel is not talking, not describing the utopian Yerushalayim with the Yerushalayim that Yirmiyah and Yeshayahu worked so hard to try to make sure wasn't destroyed standing in front of him. That's very important. It's crucial. And it's crucial because that's the crucial mistake that was made at the end of Bayit Sheni. As you had a beautiful structure, and you had a definitely far from ideal Jewish state for a while, Jewish leadership, but what else did you have? You had a lot, as we know, of Sinat Chinam. But it's not just Sinat Chinam. In my Tisha B'Av Shir 2 years ago, I discussed what the real Sina was. This was not Sinat Chinam. This was sectarian Sina. Right? They weren't upset because they didn't like the clothing that the other guy was wearing. It wasn't baseless in that sense, right? They were arguing about really important things. They were arguing about the way the Beit HaMikdash was run, about the halachot of Tuma and Tara, of purity and impurity, about how the karbanot were offered, about how the holidays were celebrated, about when the holidays were celebrated. They were arguing about important things. What happens? Look at our supplementary sources on the other side. You see the self-description of the Essenes in the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Source 6, the Serach HaYachad, Rule of the Community, one of the foundational documents of the Essenes, who lived during the end of the second Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash is standing, and where are they living? In the Midbar. Right? And what have they done? Right? They have separated themselves off in sources 6 and 7 from the rest of Klal Yisrael, who are impure, whom they have a mitzvah to hate, and they have gone to the Midbar. Bamidbar panu derech Hashem. They've established a highway in the Midbar, but the highway is not going toward Yerushalayim. It's going away from Yerushalayim. And the goal is to return to Yerushalayim, but not to the Yerushalayim that's running then, to a very different Yerushalayim. While I was in Yerushalayim, just a couple of weeks ago, went to a lecture given at the Begin Center by a young scholar who is a scholar of Dead Sea Scrolls. His name is Hillel Mali. And he pointed out that it wasn't just the Essenes. It wasn't just this small sect. This is a tiny sect. It's important. We make a big deal about the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? But when you think about it, how many people were living in that community where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found? Maybe 300, right? There are more dissertations written on the Dead Sea Scrolls than there were people living in the community of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is this tiny community. Right? It wasn't just the Essenes, though, who interpreted the Pasuk in Yeshayahu that in order to build the ideal Yerushalayim, we need to run away from Yerushalayim into the wilderness. That the highway is going away from Yerushalayim and toward the Midbar. So if you look at sources 8 through 12, just a few quotations from our resident historian of this period, Josephus. Right? If you look at the first four sources, all of them share in common, what? That you have some false prophet, in each case a different one, getting up and telling people to follow him into the wilderness. Amazing. Right? And a few of these sources, Josephus says there were numerous such prophets all over the place. They were popping up. And they all had the same message. What was the message? This Yerushalayim, which by the way, again, had just been built up more and more beautifully, aesthetically, to the greatest it had been since the first Beit HaMikdash. No doubt a very problematic Yerushalayim. A Yerushalayim that didn't meet its potential. A Yerushalayim that was not Reshit Tzmichat Ge'ulatenu. But you had the Beit HaMikdash. You had a spiritual leadership. Right? And as much as it has been pointed out by many, many, starting with the Rishonim, that the rabbis leave out the Chashmonaim from the story of Hanukkah, right? The Chashmonaim who established the thriving state of Israel during the second Beit HaMikdash, right? At the beginning of the second Beit HaMikdash in Ezra, Nehemiah, Zechariah, Haggai, right? There's no Jewish state. There's a Beit HaMikdash that the Persians are letting them build. Right? What you have with the Chashmonaim is something that one way or another, Chazal thought, was supposed to be celebrated. Right? And the Rambam, Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, one of my Rebbeim, is eager to point out, the Rambam specifically puts the success of the Chashmonaim back in the story of Hanukkah, in his telling. And if you actually look carefully, I don't think Chazal ever really took it out, because they refer to the Chashmonaim and their positive activities all over the place in rabbinic literature. Right? This problematic group that were Kohanim and nevertheless took the the melucha, the kingship for themselves, they nevertheless established the Jewish state. Problematic? Yes. But a reason to celebrate 8 days for all generations? Most definitely. Right? Not so the Essenes. Right? And what Hillel Mali has pointed out to us, not so many, many Jews who were fleeing Yerushalayim, and all they wanted was to see the real Yerushalayim. Because that Yerushalayim wasn't the real Yerushalayim. And if you look through the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's really all about the real Yerushalayim. It's about worshiping HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the real Yerushalayim. Where's the real Yerushalayim? Up there, in heaven, right? They don't have... The Kohanim who are running the real Yerushalayim are not human Kohanim. They're angelic Kohanim. But they're Kohanim nonetheless. At least they know how to get it right. We humans don't know how to get it right. By the way, in Chazal, if you look at the motif of angels in Chazal, they're very often worse than humans. Right? They're better in the sense that they're perfect. Right, but they represent the sterile perfection. For the Qumranites, perfection is what we needed. And Yerushalayim of the end of the Beit HaMikdash period is definitely not perfection. If you look at sources 11 and 12 in the supplementary sources, it's not just that they wanted to leave to the Midbar, right? And the goal was, oh, maybe we'll come back after the next election, right? When the Chashmonaim are out of power and the right people are in power. There was actually a crazy vision of a hope for the destruction of Yerushalayim. Right? A goal that the walls of Yerushalayim fall down. Right? In source 10, they're running away from Israel, cross the Yarden, the Jordan River, in the opposite direction of Yehoshua. Right? In source 12, the Beit HaMikdash is burning, and you have a prophet saying, this is the moment of redemption. Imagine that. The Beit HaMikdash that we've been mourning now, right, for 2,000 years is burning, and you have this prophet saying, this false prophet, saying this is the moment of redemption, it's about to come, because now what? We've gotten rid of the imperfect Yerushalayim. And now, we're going to get the perfect Yerushalayim back. And so what kind of Yerushalayim did these people want? We don't know everything about what they wanted. We know they had a very different conception of the way halacha was fulfilled there. And by the way, their conception of halacha was significantly more stringent than any type of halacha practiced then by Chazal or nowadays in the most Haredi of Haredi communities. But it's not just that. It was a very different Yerushalayim because it was an exclusive Yerushalayim. Who was allowed in Yerushalayim? People who were pure. And for Qumran, people who were pure meant people who were separated from this world. And in an almost ascetic way, tremendously extreme. If you look at source 13, right, the description of the ideal Yerushalayim in the scroll of the temple, right, again found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, anyone who has relations with a woman, for 3 days they have to go through a purification process before they can return to the city of Yerushalayim. Real life doesn't go on in Yerushalayim. And now you get a little bit of a sense of why these people had to run away to the Midbar. And why the only Yerushalayim that they could possibly build that would fit the bill was up there, run by the angels. I couldn't even put the source down. But you know who else was left out of this Yerushalayim? Not just people who lived in the real world, who had real lives. Women left out of this Yerushalayim. There were no women in Yerushalayim, according to the Essenes. No children in Yerushalayim. No one elderly in Yerushalayim. No one disabled in Yerushalayim.
Is this the fact?
This is
a theory.
This is definitely not the fact on the ground. This is Qumran, the Essenes, description of their ideal Yerushalayim, writing out in the wilderness. Right? That's their exclusivist Yerushalayim. Anything that relates remotely to the real world, left out.
They live
that way in the Qumran. That's another disputes between historians. Were they celibate? Were they not celibate? It seems clear that even though Philo and Josephus and other sources say they were celibate, that there are other sources that say it's very clear that they did have children. But when they had children, the children couldn't live in Yerushalayim. They had to go outside of Yerushalayim until they were of age where they could be pure and perfect. And then they could enter Yerushalayim, and then they could enter the group.
How long did that period last?
What?
How long did that period last?
This group separated off, according to historians, right after the Hanukkah story. Right after the Chashmonaim in 161 BCE, before the Common Era, established, right, won the battle against Antiochus, and over the course of time reestablished the Jewish state and Jewish political rule, and basically disappeared after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Right, so they existed for about 250 years. Right, there's a reason why they disappeared. Also, I mean, this is not such a realistic conception. What? There were groups of Essenes apparently living elsewhere as well, but the group that we know about, the Essenes that we know about, were living in Qumran at the time. I want to hold all questions for a moment. I have to end at 7 o'clock. Is that correct? Okay. So let's move on. Right. By the way, one thing that they weren't allergic to, unlike Yechezkel, was political power. You look at Josephus' description in Source 15, right? They're supposed to hate the wicked, but they are not supposed to hate people in authority. They're supposed to show fidelity to people in authority because no one obtains the government without God's assistance, right? Of course, the irony here is, well, who's in authority out in Yerushalayim? Right? You see that they are so cloistered in their own world that their world, it's the people in their world they're talking about. They're definitely not talking about the authorities in Yerushalayim at the time. They're talking about the authorities out in the wilderness, right? So that's their utopian Yerushalayim. Chazal, do they describe the utopian Yerushalayim? And you could answer the question by looking at the source sheet. Right? That's what I always do whenever someone asks a question in Shir. I look at the source sheet, because it has to have the answers. Right? Well, they definitely describe Yerushalayim, and there are definitely utopian components to it. But I don't know whether we would actually call it a utopia. It's not the opposite of a utopia. It's definitely not a dystopia. Right? It's not a place where everything goes wrong. But it's not a utopia either. It's sort of a real world. Look at Masechta Midot and Tamid, the small sections I quoted for you in sources 3 and 4, back on the first page. Right? Interestingly, they both start with the three places where the Kohanim would guard. And what do they have in this Yerushalayim, in this Beis HaMikdash? Right? They have children, women, older people, people with disabilities, right? All of the people who were left out of the Essenes, ideal, thank God, not real, Yerushalayim, right? And it's not only that, it was a real world place. Fascinatingly, both Midot and Tamid describes the same scenario. They both start out describing not only the Kohanim guarding the Beit HaMikdash, they start out describing what happens when the Kohanim are guarding the Beit HaMikdash. Well, they sleep. Right? And what can happen when a person sleeps, when a man sleeps? In both cases, what happens? Ira Keri. There's a seminal omission. In the middle of the utopian Yerushalayim. Right? And do they leave? Do they leave the Beit HaMikdash? No. They go to the mikvah in the Beit HaMikdash and they purify themselves. Right? By the way, you know what else was? I left something else that's absent in Yerushalayim of the Qumranites. Thank God for those of us who don't have strong bladders, not the real Yerushalayim. Bathrooms, no bathrooms, right? In the Yerushalayim, the ideal Yerushalayim. By the way, no bathrooms in the Qumran community, according to their own texts. Although archaeologists have found bathrooms there, so it's a little problematic. Right? And what do you have in Mishneh Tamid? The Kisei Shel Kavod. What's the Kisei Shel Kavod? It is a place where human dignity is preserved. That's the very real Yerushalayim. By the way, why do both Masechet Midot and Masechet Tamid start with these three places? What happens in these three places? The Beit Avtinas, the Beit HaNitzotz, the Beit HaMoked, right? The Beit Avtinas, that was, among other things, where the Kohen Gadol, was grilled to make sure he wasn't a tzeduki, or someone else who wasn't following Allah, right? We recognized right at the beginning that this is not a Yerushalayim that was running perfectly. The Beit HaMoked, that's where the Kohanim went to warm their feet, right? Because there was the ground, they had to have their shoes off, and the ground was cold, right? The Beit HaNitzotz, very interestingly, some of the Mefarshim specifically say we have no idea what the Beit HaNitzotz is, right? Sort of like the southwestern corner of the Lishkat of the Ezra Tanashim in Source 3, Mishneh Midot Bet Hey, all the way at the bottom, where you have our resident source on the structure of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Ezra Ben Yaakov, saying, I forgot what happened in this section, right? Again, imagine, this is the utopian Yerushalayim. Oh, our source has forgotten. What happens there? Right? So where do we... What happens at the beginning of both of these sources? We meet the Kohanim outside the doors. Because where are we coming from? Coming from outside Yerushalayim and into Yerushalayim. By the way, who else is there in Yerushalayim? The Chashmonaim. Specifically mentioned, even though they didn't have to be mentioned, the same point could have been made without mentioning the Chashmonaim. They're specifically mentioned in Masechet Tamid, Masechet Midot, Source 3, Perek Aleph, Mishneh Vav. What's going on in Chazal? The Chazal are saying, not just what was the reason for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, hatred. What was the reason for hatred? There was a conception of Yerushalayim that was so specific. And perhaps the Essenes had only one very specific conception, but so many other ones had so many other conceptions that any conception that wasn't similar to yours, you ran away and you prayed for Yerushalayim, Chas v'shalom, because we can't even imagine it, to be gone so that we can rebuild the ideal Yerushalayim. Right? It's inconceivable. Right? What's the Yerushalayim of Yechezkel? If you look at the end of Yechezkel's description, the end of the book, source 5. Water comes out of Yerushalayim. Comes out from the center of Yerushalayim. And where does it go? It goes in every which way. Every possible direction. And what does it eliminate? The Midbar. There is no more Midbar. There is no more wilderness. Because we're reaching out from the center outward. We're not running away from Yerushalayim because Yerushalayim isn't ideal. We're helping make Yerushalayim better in order for it to be the ideal. In order for its ideal and perfect state to be contagious and affect even the Midbar. Obviously, the relevance to the Jewish people nowadays is clear. We live in a very imperfect world, and Israel is an imperfect place. I think I was always somewhat troubled by people who didn't recognize the religious value of the state, but participated in the state nonetheless. But I've come to realize is that that's sort of what Chazal want. They want us to say, it might not be ideal, but we're not running away from it. We're trying to make it more ideal, better. A government doesn't always succeed in doing what you think it should do. Right? People who think they know it all are especially annoying to those of us who really do. Right? The government doesn't always get it right. It doesn't mean that chas v'shalom, we take matters into our own hands, take justice into our own hands, see it as our individual responsibility to show any other group or religion what happens when Jewish blood is taken lightly. That is not our responsibility. We live in an imperfect world, but we have a government. I think most importantly, something very beautiful that many of us have noticed in times of war, Jewish unity is easy to come by. And then as soon as crisis is over, the divisions come back. Perhaps now's the time to recognize and embrace Chazal's imperfect Yerushalayim. A Yerushalayim where even the imperfect Chashmonaim were present, where the real world was alive, where things didn't always go right, where impurity existed, and we had to work to make things more pure. I will not end this shiur by davening for Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mehera v'yameinu, not because I don't daven for it every day, I do. Right? But because we need to build one brick at a time. Take what we have, embrace it, love it, and make it better one step at a time. Kadosh Baruch Hu give us the strength to do that.